Today we are joined by Scott Bintz, graduated from Minot State University with a degree in economics. Scott founded Real Truck in 1998 in the basement of a duplex. This company has grown into a $100 million e-commerce superstore. He then sold Real Truck to Truck Hero Inc. and later started a new business, Redheaded Rebel and Redheaded Rebel Storage. Scott has written a book titled Principles of Fortune. His favorite saying is anything is possible, which speaks volumes to the type of person he is. Welcome to NDSU, Scott, and it's great to have you here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, definitely. Well, we can jump right in here. Greg, you want to just go ahead?
So I'm going to start with something a little less conventional than you'd expect. We're not going to start with talking about your business or anything. Just a little icebreaker here. If there was one song or one artist out there that was, there's only one that you can listen to for the rest of your life, what would it be and why?
Metallica, because it's power music, and I like that.
What a great answer. I like it. All right, Nick, you can kick us off with the real questions.
Okay, so first we'll jump right into the business questions here. So you were the leader over at Redheaded Rebel. Could you tell us a little bit more about what the company does? Every time we read something when we did our research about Redheaded Rebel, it seemed that there is one thing that remained constant. You're on a mission to make people's lives better. Why is that so important to the company?
Well, I think, like, oftentimes in business, obviously people are concerned about profit, but profit, I think I've always looked at it, is like blood to the human body. It's required for life, but it's not the purpose. And I think with businesses in today's world should do something besides just let's make money. And I think that there's always room for better or improvement. And if you're going to be on a mission, you might as well help people's lives along the way as well. Redheaded Rebel does a variety of things. And so I ride... some days one too many ponies and some days one too many ponies. But anyway, we do a lot of different things at Redheaded Rebel.
Sure. So what is the name Redheaded Rebel?
Well, I picked it up. I've been called a lot of names, and It was one of the more better names that I've been called over the years. It was a name I picked up dirt track racing, the Redheaded Rebel. Back when I owned Real Truck, we would have big, hairy, audacious sales goals, and if we hit them, I would shave my head, and so I'd grow my hair long, and then once we'd hit a sales goal, I would go down to Burma's barber shop, North Dakota's only female barber, and she would glaze it off.
Nice. So I like that, how Nick said earlier, the anything is possible. You often go into the details saying how that's your favorite saying. Could you just speak on that or give some example of how that actually holds true, that anything is possible?
Well, I think a lot of times people get stuck where I think, persistence and also context and one's perception of something kind of affects what we do or don't do. And I often tend to quote, hey, we put a man on the moon in 1969. Don't tell me we can't do this. This ain't that hard.
Sure.
And so kind of bringing things into context of it kind of speaks to two different things. One is when I was in college, when I was your age, I was thinking about going to law school, and someone told me, well, there's way too many attorneys now. And I thought, oh, yeah, they're right. And I didn't think much more of it and kind of shifted courses. And later, someone gave me some context to that. And they said, yeah, there's a lot of attorneys, but there's always room for a good one. Again, not implying that the current attorneys are bad, but just there's always room for better. And at Real Truck, for example, we started in my basement. And because of our work culture, we had a lot of guiding principles that kind of drove people's behavior and actions and attitudes, and we developed like an auto PO bot. So we literally processed about you know, 90%+ of our orders hands-free. So they'd come in online, they'd literally, and we were a dropship company, so we never touched any products. Okay. And so that was all automated. And that's an example of, and it was done with good old-fashioned, everyday people from North Dakota. And but that's an example of just that anything's possible. Obviously, there's people beyond my level doing things that are anything possible, you know, sending their own rockets to space and so forth. But for the average everyday entrepreneur, you know, I think it's just an attitude of like, of knocking down walls and barriers and that kind of thing. Because when you do have an idea, most of the world will tell you why it won't work. And so you have to kind of learn to overcome that.
Sure. And you said you started Real Truck in your basement. Was there ever a time during that time period where you had that same mentality and there weren't people getting behind on board with that? Or was the staff usually the same mentality as you?
No, I mean, I think it's a work in progress. You know, when you do something that's new, you know, at that time it was 1998, so the theory was nobody would buy a pickup cover for $400 online from a company that you never heard of.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually wasn't doing it to start an e-commerce company myself. I was doing it to try to get brick and mortar stores who were in truck accessories at the time, pickup accessories, who had the resources, who had the people, who had the money to set up a website and sell online. And so it was set up as a prototype for them that I would give to them, because I was working as a manufacturer's rep. Essentially what that is we repped about 15 pickup accessory manufacturers, and we set up brick and mortar stores to sell their products. And of course our company made a percentage of what was sold in that market. So if I could get 10 brick and mortar stores selling online, it would grow the business.
Right.
But none of them were interested because they were all busy with their right now business. And so Real Truck kept growing, and I would kept using that example of, hey, I'll give you the website. We'll clone it. You can have it. And most wouldn't put the time into it. And so when we got going, then it was like the first day we put the website up, we sold a pickup cover to a gentleman in Tennessee. And at that point is when we also set up our accounting operations, because I hadn't really thought of that other than getting the credit card processor. Mm-hmm. Like, how are we going to keep track of this? And I didn't technically even have an account with AgriCover, who made the pickup cover at the time. So I had to call them and say, hey, will you sell me a pickup cover and drop ship it to this dude in Tennessee? So anyway.
Cool. So another question, switching gears here. If you Google Scott Bentz online, you see a ton of success stories, right? And that's great. That's obviously what you want. But outside of that, what, like, upon your journey, what were some setbacks that you had? There's obviously adversity that you have to go through to get to where you are. So what setbacks did you have, and how did you get past those?
I think there's been a few. I mean, I owned a company called Jimmy Quick Lawn Care that didn't go very far. Okay. And then when I was in the cellular industry, I had a company called Cellular World that we sold cellular accessories. When cellular first started, none of the big players actually sold accessories for the phone. And that didn't go very far. With Real Truck, I think it was kind of finding, like, when you're new in business, you tend to do all things for all people. And so at Real Truck, it was this process of like, what separates Real Truck from everybody else that sells accessories online? And what can we do? What are a couple of things we can do better than anyone else? And so it got more into focus. Now, as we were growing, I remember when we were about 6 million in sales, the gas prices went through the roof, vehicle sales got cut 50%. I had to sell my 69 Camaro to keep Real Truck afloat. And I got really good at selling everything except truck accessories. But no, the market changed where, like, imagine if your customer base gets cut in half, sure. Right? We still grew that year by, one, being transparent with employees, where it said, hey, you know, we're headed into, you know, vehicle sales aren't what they were. We're going to have to watch the light bill better. We're going to have to be innovative. We're going to have to, all the management team's going to have to take a, mm-hmm. a pay cut. And if we pull out of this and we're not, you know, dead on the road, you know, I'll take care of you for it. And some people at that point left the company. Some people stayed on, and of course the ones that stayed on got to experience the success we would have. So even in that, those kind of things where, whether it's starting a business that goes sideways or running an existing one, there's always, you know, business is like, I've described it like a pinball machine where, you know, there's different market conditions and different things going on. And you go in there and you work it and you get better at it and you get better at it. And 10 years later, people come in and they say, boy, it's really cool that you're such a natural at pinball, that you're so good. And you look at them kind of funny because you've put probably 10,000 hours into pinball. And then one day you come in and the pinball machine is totally different.
Yeah.
Totally different market, totally different things going on, and you have to kind of keep relearning. And I think the biggest thing of like business is this aspect of like embracing ongoing change. Just because we did it yesterday this way doesn't mean we're going to do it today that way. You know, like always be asking why we do what we do, because the why changes over time.
Right. So how do those, like selling your Camaro, the people leaving the company, how does that not discourage you though? Like, how do you keep going? Light at the end of the tunnel type of idea.
Well, I think you probably get a little bit of a crazy determination, a little bit of like once you're committed and you're all in, you can do nothing but keep going. And obviously some days you're jamming a Metallica on the way to work, and some days you're like wondering if you've gotten in over your head, you know, I learned like when I had to sell a bunch of stuff to keep Real Truck afloat because we had a cash crunch. I learned then, you know, like, hey, you want to expand your lines of credit during the good times, because during the bad times, you know, bankers are not investors, they're bankers, and they do sure bets.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you learn things. I think the biggest thing is when you have setbacks is instead of looking at it of like, it was a struggle because the economy sucked. Well, I can't really learn from that. What can I learn from a bad experience that I have control of? Like, you know, there's other aspects of, you know, some of the things that we discovered is that during that time was like, people are going to probably buy a new pickup to them every 3 years. And so we got to need to look at our customers as customers for life. And we kind of shifted marketing from being this aspect of, hey, buy $200 worth of stuff from us and get free fuzzy dice, to if you bought $200 worth of stuff from us, we would surprise you with free fuzzy dice.
Okay.
So kind of wow them after the sale rather than entice them before the sale.
Right.
You know, so some of the things we did in marketing, I think, got better. Some of the things where we just, a lot of our marketing was really, not that we weren't trying to bring people in the doors, but if we could wow people after the sale, they'd tell their friends.
Sure. Kind of free marketing.
Yeah.
Was it harder at first to make the sales then because you weren't enticing them?
I think it hurt. Well, some of it depends on the marketing conditions and the market we were in on e-commerce. Companies tended to do a couple of things. One, they tended to not be as accurate on their shipping times. And so say if we could know from the data that a product would ship on average, say 2 days, a lot of companies would advertise 1 day to get the sale, you know, and even though it would take 2 days, upset the customer, but they got the sale. Mm-hmm. In our case, if we knew something shipped in 2 days, we would say 3. So we always were true to our word. And so we lost a little business initially, but most of our customers had the experience. If, you know, if it shipped when it was supposed to, it was supposed to, you don't get a bonus. If it ships a day sooner, people think, oh, it ships sooner than I thought it would.
Okay.
And it creates a kind of a memorable experience versus the other side of it being that, hey, they didn't ship when they said they would, right? And so some of our competitors that customers had that experience, we would get them over time, and then because people would say we did what we said we're going to do. And then again, we tried to wow people, whether it was sending them a humorous postcard after the sale or sending them fuzzy dice or
yeah.
cool, cool t-shirt or something like that, kind of to reinforce after the sale experience.
That's cool.
And you said that those employees that left compared to the ones that stayed, I had a question here down the line about quality of your workers. Does that speak volumes about the people that stayed even when times weren't going so great? They had to take a pay cut.
Yeah, I mean, I think it speaks to kind of loyalty. Like, I always, before we had guiding principles, I tended to hire people that I thought would be loyal as long as they could be if the wheels fell off the truck, so to speak. And because loyalty, I think, goes a long ways. And but over time, I think we also got better at hiring. Again, I'm not going to make someone feel bad if they left because they couldn't take a pay cut. Not everybody would do that deal. I just, from a leadership standpoint, wanted to be honest with the employees that, hey, we're headed into some tough times. The half of our customers aren't buying trucks like they were, so a lot of competition. We don't know what's going to happen. More so of, I think, that kind of transparency in a company is huge to employees because people want to know what's going on. I've had the opposite happen, too, where I share in the book Principles of Fortune one time where, like, if you don't share with people what's going on, they build assumptions. So we were growing so fast that we had rented, the upstairs became open, and so we rented it, and we were renovating it for more places for people to work. But what happened was I didn't get a chance to tell it too many people at the company, so a rumor started going around. That it started with someone saying, why are they doing upstairs? And then someone else said, well, I think they're building Scott an office. And then the next person said, but it's like 5,000 square feet. Why does he need an office that big? And then the next person said, well, because he's going to put a bunch of, whatever, I love Scott Bentz crap on the wall. And blah, blah, blah. And then the next person said, well, if he's building a 5,000 square foot office and going to do it over the top, none of us are going to get raises. Probably won't get a raise for 1 or 2 or 3 years. So by the time, the moral of the story, by the time it got to back to me, it was, we're building an office upstairs for Scott to have a 5,000 square feet of I love me space, and nobody was getting raises for 2 years, and because that had went kind of like all through the company, where as a leader of getting in front of it and saying, hey, this office space came available, we're growing rapidly, we want to get the space, we want to get construction going, having that 60-second conversation would have prevented a lot of fear in the workplace.
Yeah,
sure. And if I could backtrack on that, one specific example I read here was that there was a system that you guys had that was called What's Up at RT, Real Truck. So you talked about communication with all your employees, maybe negative in that aspect for that rumors were going around about the 5,000 square foot office. How is What's Up at RT different from like Skype? Did people get face to face, or was it, can you go into that a little bit there?
That kind of started as what we called it, our 9 at 9. There was 9 people on the management team, and they each had 2 minutes to share what was going on in their department, and they also had to juice one person in their department for practicing a guiding principle and one person outside of their department for practicing a guiding principle. I would take that content and I would do a video of what's up at Real Truck that we would share to everybody in the company so they could get a interactive, not interactive, but a broad picture of everything going on at Real Truck in the various departments, which would help people see how they connect to the big picture.
Sure.
And I would also do the shout outs to employees for practicing a guiding principle too. And obviously if you were a manager and you have 2 minutes to share what's going on, you tend to share the most important stuff. And so that's what that was. And then it was just me sharing about it, and we put it on YouTube as a private video or whatever and share it out, and people could watch it at their convenience. And it went over really, really, really well, at the company.
Cool.
And so different companies do it in different manners. I kind of got the it was kind of a, got the idea from when I was at Google one time, they had with the CEO of the company, it was more where he did a video thing once a week, but it was more live interactive kind of deal. But it was the same kind of concept of like when I was at Google, like, okay, you got all this stuff at Google, people could be playing softball and eating free food and all that, but why are they working so hard?
Yeah.
Like, why are they not playing volleyball all day long? I mean, or whatever. And I think it was because of just their, where they can all kind of connect how they fit into the big picture, which is huge for employee. You know, the biggest thing I think employees struggle with is feeling appreciated. And so anything you can do to increase that. And of course, with our guiding principles and our principle of be humble and getting an entire company of catching each other doing things right, didn't put all of the compliments on me happening to give compliments to everyone because everybody was catching people doing things right.
Sure. Oh, cool.
Oh, I like that.
So that seems like a good transition into, it seems like today in business, we see a much larger focus on culture of an actual company. In your book, you explain that culture is going to happen with or without guidance. Either way, culture is going to develop. So if it's without guidance, you say that it'll become competitive and cutthroat. Could you speak on that? Like, why is it so important to form a culture in a business?
Well, I think, you know, in business, obviously, there's this need to, you know, obviously companies to make a profit and to win and to do well. And I think, like, if you think about, in football, you know, sports teams have cultures,
mm-hmm.
churches have cultures, high schools have cultures, groups within those businesses have cultures and institutions, et cetera. So if you look at, for example, this is probably before your guys' time, but there was a scandal called Bountygate, and it was the New Orleans Saints, and they were paying players bonuses to hurt players on other teams. And they did this for years because, of course, they wanted to win, right? And where that became totally cool internally until word got out, and then, of course, they were publicly shamed and blah, 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 and went back to culture
right.
is what causes it. At the same token, if you have a positive culture, oftentimes people have great personal values that they live by but struggle to bring them in to work because of fear of losing their job, for example, a company might have a guiding principle, but if they let profit motive trumpet all the time, they don't really have a guiding principle. Like, how does this fit into the grant? Like, I use an example. One of our principles at RealTruck was transparency rocks, which is open and honest relationships with employees, with our business partners, with customers, right? To have, obviously, there's in a business environment, there's some HR things. You can't be saying, hey, we fired Fred because of this or whatever.
Yep.
Not that we fired a lot of people, but, you know, there's some HR things, obviously, in privacy. But, for example, one of the times, one of the people at RealTruck did an algorithm where it sorted the products by what RealTruck made the most on.
Sure.
Right?
Okay.
So, but our sorting said sorted by most popular, which was inaccurate. So we either needed to change the sort name to sort by what RealTruck makes the most money on, which I don't think people would use.
Okay.
Or do it by what's, figure out how we're going to do that algorithm for a most popular based on, was it going to be sales, unit count, what time period, whatever, but some thing that would be more accurate. That's an example of where someone, I think, was probably trying to help the company make more money, but was doing it in a non-transparent way.
Sure.
Well, if you let that slide, right, then it becomes a slippery slope on, well, if we can fudge on this, we can fudge on that. And I think sometimes in a business, you know, if you have this, people will kind of play off a tribal knowledge of what they think they should do, which may or may not be accurate. And so I think with culture, if you kind of nourish it in the direction you want it to go, like if if we're going to work 40 hours a week or 50 or 60, I'd rather do it at a place I enjoy going to. And I think that is, you know, even if you look at, like, you guys are at NDSU and the Bison football, there's a culture with that too, right? Mm-hmm, and it's a winning culture. And it's, you know, like, where people are all geared up and it's like an NFL game, and it's, you know, there's a culture of that. They're doing their horns,
yep,
signal or whatever you call it. And sorry, I've been in trouble by the game.
Horns up.
And but where there's a culture there too, that propels it too, even in its own aspect. And I think better to nourish it. I think the biggest thing is I think if you don't nourish it, oftentimes people interpret what you do as becoming the law. What the leadership does becomes the law for other people, and it may be misinterpreted, going back to like the bounty gate with the New Orleans Saints. I'm guessing most people there would say, well, you know, we're good, honest people, mm-hmm, and yet somehow this desire to win, you know, obviously if you're in football, winning equates to profit, right? You're going to sell more jerseys,
right?
Blah, 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 blah. And so that desire for profit trumped what would be a basic motive of, you know, hey, we're going to play aggressive football, but we don't want to injure someone intentionally.
Sure.
And so where that becomes totally cool is, again, an example of where a culture getting out of hand.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kind of jumping ships a little bit here. Kind of doing a little bit of research on you here. Coming up into your... when Real Truck was becoming bigger and bigger, as a CEO and running the company, how many hours would you say you put in a week typically? If not, it varied, but typically the typical 7-day work week, 6-day work week, how many hours do you think you put in a week there?
Probably when it, you know, first started, I was probably putting anywhere from 60 to 80 hours a week. And wow. Then,
wow.
Probably after that, and to give context to that too, I think after that was probably 40 to 60, you know, in that, just like athletes, there's two things I think that, well, flow or the zone. If you're an athlete, if you get in the zone,
sure,
if you're the rest of us, it's called flow, where you're doing something you enjoy so much that time passes like you're standing still. And so it's not like, sometimes obviously work's work, that's why they call it work, not play, and it's tough and you have to do things you don't necessarily like doing for the greater good, but there's often times where, like, as the company's growing, I could do more of the things I like doing. And so it wasn't like it felt like I was working that much, but obviously as you get older, then you strive for, you know, work-life balance and all of that kind of thing. Or people tend to go one or two ways of, like, either, like, well, you know, I'm a worker, or they strive for work-life balance. In my particular case, you know, I've always kind of had like a rock in my shoe where I'm always like thinking about things, and I'm always like trying to improve things and trying to, like, I'm just kind of wired where I'm always thinking about business things. Even when I take a vacation in Germany or something like that, I'm looking at how they do business and how they're I don't know. So, but anyway, it's not, I don't know too many entrepreneurs that can be successful without a degree of work. But just like with football, you know, there's some NFL coaches that work 80 hours a week. And then you had coaches like Tony Dungy, who was like 40 hours a week, period.
Sure.
If I can't take us to the Super Bowl on 40 hours a week, then it ain't that important. You know, I don't know if that was his exact.
Yeah, sure.
But so I think it's probably an individual thing. But for me, it was probably on average, I probably worked 60 hours a week.
Okay. Yeah, and just doing some playing around on the internet, I read a statistic that said a third of those hours a week typically for a CEO comes on the weekend. Did you think that held true on your come up in real truck, or is that?
Yeah, I mean, I think I tend to be, I'm kind of a pusher from the back. And so when I have to do extroverted things, I tend to be doing that and chatting with people. And then when I work, I tend to work by myself without too many interruptions, because that way I could get into the zone. And so I did do some stuff. Well, obviously on the weekend, you don't have the phone ringing as much and that mm-hmm. kind of thing. And so it was more back room working if I did work on the weekends. And then of course I picked up a dirt track racing habit, so that turned my work week into a 4-day work week in the summers. So.
Sure.
You know, that just makes me think, like, it seems like today there's this narrative that, at least I see it all over social media and stuff, that like CEOs don't deserve all the money they get because they're not the ones out there with their hands in the dirt doing the actual work. But hearing, like, you're putting in 68 hours a week, like, you've been through that. You've been through what it takes to get this thing going. What are your thoughts on that, like, narrative that CEOs are just in their cushy offices and they don't deserve the money that they get?
Well, I think it kind of depends on probably context to it, meaning, obviously, the, you know, 30 years ago, there was, you probably had to be working for a Fortune 500 company to really be a CEO. And so in today's world, there's thousands of CEOs that are one-person offices. So, and I always referred to myself as a self-appointed CEO. So so it wasn't like I had been hired to be the CEO.
Right,
CEO. Sure. But where it's like, well, you stuck with me. I think, I don't know where I think in the aspect that there's a need for, how can I put this, that I had a friend of mine that owned about 50 or 60 Kentucky Fried Chicken restaurants. Mm-hmm. And he went by the motto of, he should never make more than 7 times the lowest paid employee.
Okay.
Obviously, he didn't become a billionaire, but at the same token, he lived pretty good. Mm-hmm. And so he always had to, like, raise the front line if he was going to make more money. And so I think there's probably, I think just like in anything, obviously there's people that could do other things. You know, there's a lot of people maybe could go into the military and be great leaders there that go into the private sector, and they're going to be paid accordingly to their performance and that kind of thing. I think where CEOs get a bad rap is where you find out, hey, the company's lost $20 million and the CEO's made a pile and also got a bonus, and where when you get, and again, I think that's where you kind of get some of that, the bad side of what you hear of corporate America, where, like all things, there's some really great apples and there's some not so great apples. And I think, you know, obviously in America, you know, we idolize the aspect of, like, starting with nothing and developing into something. Yeah. You know, my story coming from the trailer park to where I've come to is really a cool story. Mm-hmm. And I think it's an even cooler story if you also bring a lot of people with you when you do that, rather than, I've never wanted my legacy to be, hey, everybody, through dumb luck, I started an internet company that grew a bunch and I got rich. Aren't y'all happy for me? I wanted my legacy to be that, that I've helped make people's lives better. And, you know, when you're a CEO for a company, self-appointed or otherwise, there's family, there's kids, there's, you know, the even with Real Truck, I think when I'd left there, we had like 130 employees maybe. Well, that connects, that we used to send all the kids of Real Truck a $10 bill on their birthday, but that equates to, you know, probably 600 people that you're responsible for when you add in husbands, wives, kids, etc. And I think that one has to take that into account of with income, where sometimes, you know, if you look at in America anyway, sometimes there is a pretty big income separation from, I mean, I don't know, does Bill Gates really need $8 billion?
Right.
Like, where there's probably how you, what's best to do with that, I don't know. But again, where I think sometimes it gets a little out of hand with that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly where you've had, like even with Uber, you know, Uber's really cool, but it baffles me that, like, how do they keep the doors open where the, when they're losing, don't they lose? Well, I don't know. Last time I read about it, I don't know if it was 5 million or 5 billion a quarter. Like,
oh, wow.
And obviously the people that started that are cajillionaires from the platform, but they still haven't made a nickel, right? Mm-hmm. So someone's going to pay for that.
Yeah.
Yep.
Unless they turn it around.
Right.
Which you'd think they could, because it's, but who knows? I don't know nothing about that kind of stuff. But anyway, that's a little all over the board answer to your question. So
no, yeah,
it's great.
I like it. We're approaching here 37 minutes. I know you said you're not short on time, but we definitely can't go too far over. If it's all right with you, wrap up question here and then get yourself on the road here if you want. Lastly, do you have any advice for us entering? We're both juniors right now, finishing up college, entering the real world here, with a mindset we can go off to.
I think with people, I always say, you know, follow your passion and you'll figure out a way to make enough money to do your passion. If you follow the money, you probably won't enjoy it. So always follow your passion, realizing that you'll probably figure out enough money to you'll figure out a way to make enough money to do your passion. Now, if you're an artist, for example, you might have to paint for 30 years and work at Starbucks, but nonetheless, I think it more has to do with, like, where sometimes people get caught up in following the money and then they wonder 10 years later why they're not enjoying it, versus if you can find something that, like, connects you to something where you can really stay passionate about it. And then also just to keep digging, because again, if you're on the entrepreneur side and you say, hey, I got this great idea, most people were going to tell you, reinforce to you all the obstacles. Like, even when I wrote a book, a friend of mine said, well, you're not a writer. That postponed the book for a year, because it's, yeah, you're right, I do kind of suck at writing. and then I thought, wait a minute, too many people have written books. It can't be that hard.
Yeah.
Now, it might be hard to write a good book, but it ain't that hard to write a book.
Sure.
So, anyway, thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah
absolutely. Thank you so much for coming out here.
Taking time out of your schedule to be here. It's awesome.
Yeah, absolutely.